Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing two interviews that I did last year and didn't get a chance to air. They are both with remarkable actors. The first interview is with Michael James Leslie, who was, as I say in the first moments of the show, the Joe in the first production of the Oslo season, Showboat. It was an amazing performance, and he's a fascinating guy. The second interview is with a wonderful, wonderful actor who is part of the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company, David Breitbarth. Last year was in You Can't Take It With You, Glengarry Glen Ross, and Clybourne Park. These are remarkable men, both of whom didn't start out life thinking this would be their life, and yet, for both of them, it is very definitely their life. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. I play interviews that I did with people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the two interviews that I am airing today are both of men who are who they really are. They are doing what they must do with their lives. Both of these men say that while being an actor, while dedicating one's life to the art of acting, is not always easy, not always financially safe, they are doing what they must do. They are doing what they need to do. They are being who they are. These are remarkable men, incredibly talented men, and their stories, while very, very different, somehow wind up making the same point. The first interviewee is Michael James Leslie. You will hear right at the start that big voice. If you didn't get a chance to see him in Showboat last year, you missed an extraordinary experience. And just listening to Michael is in itself an extraordinary experience, so I'm not going to say anything more. Here is Michael James Leslie.
I'm here with Michael James Leslie, who is the Joe in the Oslo Repertory Theater production of Showboat.
Yes.
And I really wanted to interview you because you're so pivotal to the show and because that performance is so extraordinary.
Oh, my, thank you so much. Thank you.
Oh, my God. And I mean, this, of course, you have heard over and over. I know I'm not the first person to say this. Lots of singers sing that song.
Yes, and I've sung it for 20 years. But this is the first time I've actually done the role.
Yes.
And so that's a tribute to Rob and them who chose me because they said I'm too emotional. A lot of times they want the Old Man River to be removed, a little bit slightly removed, so that people don't think about race. They don't think about anything. It just becomes a museum piece. So anything editorialized, a lot of the people that are doing Showboat don't like it.
Wow.
And Rob did, and not just Rob, Michael Edwards, who
yes.
was really, who was in the audition, and I could see he was moved.
Yes.
And so so it's after 20 years of singing it, and I've done it with the Key West Pops Orchestra, and having this extraordinary reaction, and then going in to audition for the role of Joe, and not getting it. They just, it's something. They don't want it.
No, they're afraid of it.
Yeah, well, I'll let you say that.
I'll say it, of course. But that's the point, isn't
yes,
it? That's
yes.
the point of the role.
Yes, I mean, exactly. And the thing is with me, what I'm thinking of when I'm doing that song, it fits in the storyline of it, but it's my own personal thing. And my own personal thing is that I had a friend who was dying, and I was by his bed, and he put his hand on my hand and he said, "Why don't you sing Old Man River?" And I looked at him like this because I didn't understand where that was such a non sequitur. What do you mean? He said, "Why don't you sing Old Man River?" I said, "Well, I don't like that song." I said, "Because it's about, you know, it's an old black guy and he's standing on a river and life goes on and he doesn't do anything and blah, 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 blah." And then he rubbed my hand and he said, "You must always sing that song." And so 2 years later, I got a chance to do it at a concert. And in the middle of the song, it all of a sudden occurred to me what he was saying, that it's about so much more.
Yes.
Old Man River, that's why it reverberates. It's about your life.
Right.
It's about my life, all
wherever
of
our
you
lives.
Came
that's
from.
Right.
And we've all, whatever our ethnic group or whatever it is, we've all had struggles. And one of the most important lines in that song is, let me go away from the Mississippi, let me go away from the white man boss. Show me that stream called the River Jordan. A lot of people overlook that. To Afro-Americans, that's the way out. It's not Mississippi, the Old Man River. It's the way out of where you're doing. And every ethnic group has that metaphor that carries them through their struggles. So that's what's going on in my mind. So even though it might be emotional, I'm not saying to white people or anything anywhere else, "Oh, you should be guilty, you should be guilty." It's not that. My own personal journey is in that song.
Well,
and that's why it hits.
And who doesn't identify with tired of living, scared of dying?
Dying.
I mean, come on.
It's sick
so,
of trying.
Right, yes,
I mean,
right.
You know, and how many of us have been there? So you good singers, and I'm not, you know,
don't do
aggrandizing
that.
Myself.
Just don't do that.
But carry the listener on a journey. And some of the Old Man Rivers I've heard have been sort of a very Wagnerian baritone guy who stands up and he just bellows the song and it's like an opera kind of thing.
Right.
Well, even great opera singers carry you on the journey, you know. And
well,
so you have to, I start out small,
yes,
and then
do.
I pull you along. And then when it becomes the thing about crossing over, and it is about crossing over, then it gets more, you know, emotional and more powerful, you know.
Yeah. It's extraordinary. Okay, so I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Okay.
And I think if you're not making your living in your life with your voice at it, you better be.
Exactly.
And I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the first moment in your life when singing, songs, music called you, seemed interesting?
Oh, that's a great question. There are two of them, and one of them's odd. My mother loved the theater. I was a lawyer. I became a lawyer, and then I left law and went into show business.
Okay, I want to hear that. I want to hear that story. So take me back to the beginning.
But I graduated Rutgers College, and then I graduated Cornell Law School. I practiced for 6 months, and then I was involved in a case that I hated. It was a rape case, and basically the guy had done it. And I walked into the boss and said, I can't do this because this guy did it. And he said, and he was correct, that everyone deserves a right to be, we can't make that decision with your moon in the seventh house kind of feeling about him. And so we defended him, we got him off, and then 3 months later he committed another rape. I knew he was that way when he sat down with me. I have a second sense about those kind of people like that. And so I left. I told my mother, I'm going to New York. And I don't know what I'm going to do, but for the next 6 months, I can't do it. I said I like New York, and literally a month before I was going to take the New York bar, I got a Broadway show, which was the first revival of Hair in 1977. So, and then I never looked back. So an answer to your question, the first one was my mom loved the theater and loved performers, and she used to always take us to see the Supremes. And the first time I saw them, we went to the Copacabana in New York, and they came out, and they would do their hit, and then they would do a Rodgers and Hart in Italy, then they would do their hit, and then they would do something from Julie Stein, and then they would do their hit. And I was just transfixed. I went, and they sang in a way that I sang, which was more, not so much, I didn't have an R&B sound in my voice, even young. It was more poppy. I listened to Frank Sinatra. I loved my first song I can remember is Gokey Grant singing "The Wayward Wind Is a Restless Wind." I mean, that's the kind of thing. It was odd for an Afro-American child, but that's what I love. So they influenced me a lot, and so it's odd for a guy to say the Supremes influenced him. But they were classy, elegant, and sort of pulled us all up when we saw them. They were glamorous, and and it was almost to the point of being scripted, but they still were wonderful for us. If at Sullivan Show, they were on all the time, so we would, Sunday night, we would sit and wait for the Supremes. What gowns are going to wear? What are they going to sing? Oh, my God, they're doing a Fats Waller medley. It was just brilliant. And the second thing was mother took me to see Pearl Bailey's Hello, Dolly, and that was the capper. It was with Cab Calloway and a woman named Emily Yancey, who played Mrs. Malloy, who was just genius. And
how old were you?
I was 17. So it was...
So this is a long evolution, right?
Yeah, it's
so,
a long evolution.
Yeah, this is a long... But you're already singing. So when did you start singing? Because you...
Well,
clearly,
I've always been singing, and it's a traditional thing of the church. But I grew up in a conservative church. A lot of people who think of Afro-Americans in church, they think it's a stereotypical jumping around, holy
right,
roll.
Right, right.
Most of the churches are very conservative, and you don't do that. Everybody comes in, they're dressed, they're thing, because they're imitating the society, and what it's like doing cotillions,
Because
you're imitating what you want to be in the world.
Right.
And so you don't jump around, because that's the negative thing of us, supposedly.
So are you saying that you sang in choir, or you just sang in the congregation?
I sang in a junior choir, and then one day a woman passed out, and she was singing How Great Thou Art. And she was down near me, and then I started finishing the song, and my mother didn't know I sang, and she sort of looked at this, her
son. You mean you were sitting in the congregation?
Mm-hmm. And I just, something said, sing, finish the song.
And how old were you?
10.
And your mother didn't know you sang?
No.
Did you know you sang?
Yes, but embarrassingly so.
Yes.
The thing we do to ourselves.
So you loved it, but you didn't share it.
No.
No.
No, it was something that we, I think that everybody has a song. I mean, you have a song, and you may think that your voice is not good enough, or it would be silly to sing it, but it's that song that it's in your head, and that you sing when you're in the shower.
So Did you sing in your room? Did you sing in the street? How did you sing?
I sang along with the radio, sang in the street, sang along.
Yes, right.
Yeah, because we kept, I'm in my 60s, so that was an incredible time.
Yeah.
I mean, I can remember when I first heard Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, mm-hmm. and my mother thought I had gone, that something had happened to me. I was sitting in the car, and you heard, how does it feel? And just being transported.
Do you know how old you were?
Then I've been 14, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm guessing that this started for you quite young.
Yes.
This connection to the music, the impact that it had on you, that it didn't necessarily have on everybody else.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. It started very early, and I think that the first time I heard the audience and realized that it was an audience rather than something in church or something like that was I was in sixth grade, and they wrote a show, and the teacher thought it would be funny if I sang "Who Put the Overalls in Mrs. Murphy's
Chowder?"
And he put a shamrock tie on me and a hat. And when I was rehearsing it with them, I felt people were laughing at me, and I didn't like it. So that night, and I turned to television and saw Sammy Davis Jr. And Sammy Davis Jr. performed as though tomorrow his life may be over, and he's going to give it to you. He's going to give it to you. And a bell went off. And so that when we did it, then I rehearsed it the way the teacher wanted me to. And the night of the show, I performed as though I was the greatest, you know, the greatest 6-year-old of this. And there was a standing ovation in the grammar school. And his name's Mr. Bay, and I walked off the stage, he looked at me and he said, "You're very smart, aren't you?" Because he wanted it to be the joke.
Yes.
The black guy singing the Irish songs. I wanted you to be with me. And that continues to this day.
Wow.
I don't want you to laugh at me.
No.
You know, we're insecure.
No, but how old did you say you
were? I was, well, that was sixth grade, so that might have been 11, 12, so it's all happening about the same time.
Yeah, but it's clear, what did it take for you to deny this so that you could get through law school?
I never denied it. Even at the time of, in law school, I was doing Gilbert and Sullivan. And I became famous at Cornell for doing, people who know me will smile when I say this, doing the Mikado playing Cuba and the Mikado. So there was this Afro-American saying, you know, I was in point of fact a particularly exclusive person and haughty person of that pre-Adamite ancestral descent. You will understand this. I was doing that. You know? And so the whole thing was that. So it was...
It was always there. But you didn't take it seriously? I mean, you didn't say...
You know, I come from that generation, and probably you do too, where the mother was, the education was the most important thing, and she was right.
Yeah.
I now know she was right, but I basically did it for her. Basically what happened was, you get the degrees, and you handed it to her. You hand them to her.
Right.
And then it was a point that she couldn't say anything anymore. I graduated high school, I graduated college, I graduated law school, and then when I said, I need to do this for myself, because I don't believe, and I don't want to be overly dramatic, I don't believe I would be alive now had I not made that decision at that point. And a lot of my law school graduates, who are now big lawyers and they're in Washington, D.C., and they're commerce department, and they're you know, doing very, very, very well, are my biggest supporters because they all had talents that they denied
because
they wanted to be for their parents.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, one would think that's an uncommon story.
No, but it's not. And the thing is that there's so many talents that there's a lot of, if you talk to 10 lawyers, they'll say, I wrote, or
yes.
I sang, or I wrote songs, or I drew. There was something that other talent that they had. But we come from a generation where it was very important for the education. I don't regret it at all because it's a way of thinking, it's a way of talking, it's a way of, I can take a lot of information and look at a lot of information and get to the center.
Oh yeah, you have skills.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And my grandmother was raised by a Jewish family, so we were taught to use our brains, not our hands, that, you know, as long as you had your brains, you could outthink anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what the situation is and the impression is or whatever's going on, you can outthink them. And so in my own family, I have a brother that's another brother that's a lawyer, a brother that's a doctor, I have a sister who's a psychiatric nurse, and then a brother who's an architect. And so there's a story there that this Jewish tradition carried down to this black child. And we don't tell those stories. We tell the stories of the discord, the differences.
Yeah.
But really what it is, this is about the similarity. And what's happening in America now bothers me, I guess, because we are so demarcated and talking about how different we are when it basically comes down to it, when you're in spitting distance of, say, Peter, whatever you call that, it's all stripped away, and who you are as the person is what's going to matter, and I think that we're forgetting that.
It's interesting. The intention of my show is to say that childhood quite often cheats us out of abilities, skills, talents, and that I believe that life is better when you can use all of what you
Absolutely.
Are. Absolutely. And that it's not too late.
No.
And so you're a perfect...
No, you're not. It's not too late. And also the fact is that, God, whatever you believe in, wants you to use your talents because those were given to you.
And it most comes people, with the territory
exactly,
of being you.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so if you're not exploring all of the areas of who you are, then it's like, I gave you those talents and you're not
and
using
them. And you're not
it.
Using them.
So even if you sing and it's in a community, whatever it is, and
right.
it's in the choir
mm-hmm.
or it's something so that you can sing your song, if there's been anything... that has been said of me over my career is that he touches us. I've been told that from the time I was a child, and I still sing in church in New York. And I don't even know what I'm doing half the time. I just sort of sing, and then people will walk up and touch me or kiss me. Or I've had all extraordinary, almost spiritual experiences. One woman I was singing, Is It Well With My Soul, and I could see this woman's eyes looking and looking and looking at me, and then I walked up and she said, my husband just died, and that is his favorite song. I just didn't think I could go on without him. And she said, it was him talking to me. And she said, so thank you so much. And this little woman, who probably had never kissed an Afro-American on the lips before, put my hands on her face and kissed me, and she said, you have no idea. She just walked away with tears in her eyes. Well, when you can do that...
Well, but you know what I keep thinking as you're talking is that someone with this level of sensitivity to other human beings, how could you possibly have been a lawyer?
Yes. I always say that the way that I became an actor or singer-actor was divine inspired. I walked on 13th Street Playhouse in New York, walked by, saw that there was an audition for it. I had no music, I had no picture and resume. Walked in and I said, can I audition? And the guy who said, no, this is an agent's audition, you can't audition. I said, oh, okay. And I walked out and he said, wait a minute. Can you come back at 5:30? No, I'm scared. So I said, yeah. So I came back at 5:30. And didn't know that I was auditioning for this Broadway revival of Hair. And there was Tom Horgan and Jared Radney and Rado and all the people involved with Hair. And I sang Maybe This Time, and they just stared at me. And then I was actually taking a bar review course and got the call that I'd gotten for Broadway revival of Hair with Peter Gallagher, who we weren't a success, but those friendships have carried on for years.
Well, and it said to you...
Yeah.
It was a neon sign.
To go from nowhere. And I had been doing sort of stand-up comedy at the Comic Strip in New York. I would do the comedy, and then I would sing at the end. So I got sort of known for that, like this big black guy sings. And Larry David was the MC. And he would say that Michael Leslie sings so loud, your clothes fly off. They used to joke. I was the loudest singer they'd ever heard.
You have given a life to the work of singing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to say something about what that's like?
It's quixotic, soul-feeding, depressing. In the end, I'm as poor as a church mouse. I look at my lawyer friends who are, mm-hmm. They have $1 million homes and they've got Mercedes and all the things. I have nothing. And, I'm in debt but I feel... at the end of the night spent, and that means that I've given to the world what God gave to me.
Yeah.
And I think that in doing that, I'm getting a little emotional, but that you're close to Him.
Yeah.
And so when I leave this earth, I can say, I gave. And a lot of people can't, mm-hmm. because they're not doing where their, what their hearts are. And people, I know, listen, if I can do it, I mean, there are times I don't have rent, there are times I don't have food, and I mean, well, you're looking at me, obviously I eat, but...
he's a very big guy.
But, you know, what you say your radio program says mm-hmm. to people, even if you're 75 and there is something that you want to do, we have so little time. And if you don't do it, what was your life? If your whole life has been for your kids, make it about you. Now, I've made it about me, and I'm not attached, or I'm not married, or anything like that. But what the important thing is it's an individual, is what you've done in your life.
Yes.
You know? Yes. And so you've got to do the thing. You know what I say? Do the thing that makes you come alive. We have a lot of people that are walking around dead. They're walking live and they're dead because they did not do the thing that made them come alive. Do the thing, whatever it is. You know, if it's, you know, working at a soup kitchen, singing in a choir, acting on stage even though you've never acted before, taking a voice lesson. Do you know how many older people I've spoken to who took voice lessons and said, oh my God, you know, I never knew I had that. It was in me, you know. Do the thing that makes you come alive.
It's a perfect place to stop. Thank you so
You're
much,
absolutely
Michael.
You're welcome.
Do the thing that makes you feel alive. Wow. And when you listen to Michael, you know you can hear the aliveness in the man. He is brimming over with life. And he's made the deal that maybe we're all asked to make in the end. What is my life really about? What is it that is special to me, different for me? What is it about me and my life and my skills and what I am good at or what I love? What is it that makes me a unique individual? In a couple of weeks, I'm going to be playing an interview with Harry Bryce, who's a choreographer, an actor, and a director. And he says that he learned early in life from an extraordinary mentor that he was unduplicatable, that he was one of a kind, and that it was his obligation to honor that uniqueness, that one of a kindness. To believe in his unduplicatability and love it and use it. And he did. And you can hear in Michael. He has lots of skills. He's so bright. He got through law school and took the bar and got a job and all that stuff. But that is not what is special and unique to Michael. What is special and unique to Michael is that when he sings, he touches people. And as I said in the beginning, if you didn't get to see him do Old Man River, you missed an extraordinary experience. Because as he says, and as was said in all the reviews, so many people do that song, but nobody inhabits it the way Michael does. So my next interview is with David Breitbarth, who, as I said in the run-up, is part of the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company and has been for most of his professional career. You'll hear how that occurred. In a way, like Michael, David didn't start his life out thinking he wanted to be an actor. He stumbled upon it. It was done to him, sort of. But once he got on stage, he knew that it was his. And like Michael, he is dedicated to the art for the art's sake. So David has another separate, very unique and interesting story, and I'm going to let him tell it. So here's David Breitbart.
I'm here with David Breitbart in the little conference room at the Oslo. And David has been part of the Oslo Repertory Company for
17 years.
I explained to David that I ask people how they found this work. Not the very first job they ever got, but where did an interest in being on stage or being a character or any of that?
I had no aspirations at all in my childhood to perform in front of people. I was and still am to a degree shy. But I was a trombone player as a kid, and I was pretty good for a while. A New Jersey All-State band, I think, and then I went to a boarding school, a sort of a progressive, hippy-dippy kind of small boarding school in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, where if you weren't required, you were urged to try everything. I was in the school orchestra as a trombonist. And
now, wait a minute. Were you thinking of making music a career?
No.
No, you do it just...
No, I secretly hated playing the trombone. I started playing the trombone because my best friend in fourth grade, Billy Hawthorne, played the trombone. He played the trombone, and I wanted to play the trombone, too. But playing the trombone is lonely business. I mean, you know, it's not like... It's like, ooh, I got to meet that trombone player.
Yes, it's nice.
You know...
No, right.
So in this high school I went to, where you were encouraged to try everything, you know, even if you were missing a leg, you were encouraged to try to play soccer.
Wow.
There's that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. Reach for it.
I'm exaggerating. But, you know, it was part of, like, what the school believed about evolving and growing up and finding out who you were and what you like to do. And I got thrown onto a stage.
Well, so in your case, it actually worked.
In my case...
You discovered something that you didn't know about yourself. They put you there.
I discovered that I enjoyed, I had fun doing it. It brought me out of my shy shell a little bit. I got a lot of attention from girls. That was a big part of it. In fact, it was the only part of it in high school, at least. And I didn't know it at the time, but I really loved being part of a good story, mm-hmm. you know, and figuring out what my role was in telling a story with other people.
So it's a joint thing. It's this is fun to do. This puts me in a fellowship, in a community, in a right?
Yeah. And the school was real big on community too. It's sort of a commie, you know, liberal school. So they were real big on community, and you know, theater is community. I mean, you can't do it with other people without other people.
No, that's right. So this is really kind of interesting. I mean, I think unusual. I mean, I think a lot of people who become actors have an inclination that they want to do something like that very young, but really this came as a surprise to you.
Yeah, it did, totally.
Right.
It did.
So here you are in high school. Did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
No,
you were just coasting.
Well, I was in high school, yeah.
Well, oh my...
I was coasting. Yeah, I didn't know what I wanted
to do. Right. You were, this is, you know, it's freshman, it's sophomore, it's junior, I'm here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, but as you approach senior, people start talking to you about what you want to do, don't they?
Somewhat. You mean in terms of where to apply to college?
If you're going to go to college?
Well, yeah, I went to a liberal arts school. My parents felt strongly, and the guidance people at the school felt strongly that everyone should get a liberal arts education.
Right.
That's
so again, by now you still don't have a burning passion and a desire thing you're going to do it.
I questioned whether I wanted to be an actor through my 30s. And maybe into my 40s. I question it all the time. I sort of know I want to do it now, partly because I don't know what else I'd do at this point. But no, I've been questioning it all along.
Right. Okay, so when you question it, I'm assuming that the question has to do with, do I really still want to do this, or is this something that fulfills me and makes me happy? Not, there's something else I really want to do.
It has never been that for me, no. I've never woke up one morning and said, my God, I have got to try, you know, commercial law cases. That never happened to me. But the doubts are usually, you know, because it's not an easy business to be in.
No.
And if you can't do it, then you're not enjoying it because you're looking
for it.
For it.
Right.
And I've been very, very fortunate person to have had this job here at the Oslo because I haven't had to look for work, really.
No.
I've only had to worry about how to do it.
Yes. Well, I will say, and you are not going to say it, but I will say it, it doesn't have anything to do with luck.
But it does. It really does. I mean, there are countless talented people in the world who just haven't had the right, they haven't, like, whether it's by choice or by chance, haven't gone down the right path.
Okay. So how did you lock into this?
Well, to this job here?
Yeah.
Well,
were you working as an actor before, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I was working as an actor and living in New York City and auditioning. Mm-hmm. And I auditioned for Howard Millman, who was directing a play called The Immigrant, which is a play he directed often around the country. And a lot of theaters were doing it. A lot of people were hiring Howard to do it. And actually, the first time I auditioned for him for The Immigrant, I didn't get the job because I didn't know the Yiddish well enough. And so the second time I got an appointment to audition for the play, I called up an old wizened Jewish guy who I knew from another play and who grew up speaking Yiddish and had him teach me Yiddish over the phone.
Oh my God.
And so
Oy vey.
And so I went into the audition and auditioned for Howard again, and he offered the job to me. And it went very well. And he offered it to me several times after that. And then finally when he was rehired to come back into the office.
Oh, he wasn't here then.
He wasn't here then. No, he was running the Jiva Theater in upstate New York.
Yes.
And directing freelance around the country as well. And so when he got the job here in 1995, I think, I told him that I would be interested in coming to Florida. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. And his second season, when he decided to do The Immigrant here, he called me and said, I'm doing The Immigrant, and by the way, you can be in Nicholas Nickleby and three other plays too. And I said, okay. I'll call him if you can guarantee me more than 1 year. And he said, I'll give you 3 years.
Right.
On a handshake. And I knew I could trust him.
So you assumed that it was a 3-year gig?
I assumed that I would be here at least 3 years.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And he said the same thing to Jimmy Clark, too,
mm-hmm.
at the same time. Because, you know, if you're in the business in L.A., you go out of town for 2.5 seconds
they
and they forget
you.
Who you are.
Right. Right.
And if you never had a name to begin with, I mean, it's just you're starting over every time you go out.
So I suppose in some kind of cosmic way, the fact that you made this connection to Howard when you did was luck.
Well, it was as lucky as any actor meeting anyone else who rehires them in the future and changes their life and their career.
Exactly,
but Howard literally changed my life.
Well,
for the better.
Lots of, I don't know. I think that it's possible that a lot of actors would not have done what you did about learning Yiddish.
Oh, no. Yeah. No, a lot of actors would. I mean, the actors who booked The Immigrant before me,
yeah.
I mean, they
all
didn't know any Yiddish.
Right. Okay. So then you got here, and you stayed here. So do you want to talk about what it's like to have been in a repertory company for 17 years?
Well, sure. What do you want to know?
Well,
it's odd because it's more like a job than what most actors experience when they go to work somewhere.
Yes.
I mean, most actors, and certainly I lived this life before I came here, you book a job and you had it usually if you were working a regional theater job outside of New York or L.A. or wherever you booked it from, that it was 7 or 8 weeks out of your life where you would meet new people and do a play and then you'd be done and then you'd come back to New York or L.A.
And start again.
Auditioning again. And so the jobs themselves had this sort of, I don't know how to describe it, sort of like a you know, sort of like a vibrating glow about them.
Yes,
there was like, I got this job.
Right,
I'm going to go off and do this job. And it was like something really, really exciting. It sort of made you feel like a little kid. You know, I have this job, so I don't feel like, you know, every time a rehearsal starts,
right,
I don't feel
that
anymore.
Right. Oh, yeah.
I get excited about doing parts and plays and working with directors and certain actors, but
God, this is such an interesting thing. This had never occurred to me. It's the good and the bad about being a freelance actor. I mean, on the one hand, you're always having to look, but on the other, when you get the job, it's like Christmas.
Yeah, if it's a good job. But it's not always
a
good
job. No, that's right. That's right. Okay, so that's an interesting perspective. Do you want to talk a little bit about the plays that you're in at the moment?
It's been a remarkable season for those of us who have been acting in the company this year, because all the plays are great plays and fun to do, and completely different each one.
Yes, oh my God.
It's brilliant. Play selection that Michael did this year, covering, you know, various aspects of the American character. And
okay, so you have been awarded
Bluntfontein Acting Fellowship from Ten Chimneys, which is a foundation in Wisconsin. Ten Chimneys is now a museum in a place called Genesee Depot, which is about 40 minutes outside of Milwaukee. And it's the estate that Alfred Lunt and Joan Fontaine built. And it's gorgeous. It's just a beautiful estate in the middle of the woods. And Laurence Olivier went there, and Helen Hayes and Noel Coward. I mean, they would have these sort of summer-long parties, and each of them had their own little cottage.
Oh.
And it's like a little compound. And it's now a museum, as I said. And every year, for the past 7 years, I guess, they have had fellowship weeks where they have picked 10 actors from around the country to come to Ten Chimneys for a week and study with a master teacher. And one summer, the first summer I believe was Shakespeare, and one summer, the last year I think, was Joel Grey and American Musical Theater. And this year it's Alan Alda, who is going to do something about spontaneity on the stage. It's a pretty broad topic. We all strive to be spontaneous, or to appear spontaneous at least. So it's going to be interesting to see what he's going to, you know, putting us through.
Yes.
But it's just an awesome honor. I mean, it's like, it's an amazing thing. I just hope to hear a lot of great stories and meet some really fine, talented actors.
And have a hell of a time.
You know, apparently they wine you and dine you really well, and they put you up in a really nice boutique hotel, and they fly you out there, I think first class, I don't know. but it's just, you know, the thing about working here at the Oslo, as opposed to a place like Los Angeles, which I don't miss at all. I mean, I knew within a week of being in Los Angeles that I didn't have the kind of ambition that you need as an actor to make it there.
To
work mm-hmm. consistently. Mm-hmm. I just was not interested in spending my life sort of networking, you know, in your sleep and going to a friend's house for dinner or stopping to get gas. Everyone seems to have a screenplay that's optioned everywhere. It's like I found it so tedious. And so when I was offered this job, I pounced on it, not only because it was like work and consistent work, but that I didn't have to think about running my life in that way. And it was a relief because I absolved myself from garnering that kind of recognition, which to me is not useful, either as an artist or as a person. And so what's funny, and what I'm getting around to, is that what's funny about this getting this award is that I have this sort of, I guess it's, you know, within some circles, it's national recognition. You know, I mean, a lot of, you know, people who care about this sort of thing know that, you know, they have a list of names and they see mine's on it. I didn't try to get it, and I don't know how to deal with it. You know, I'm not equipped. I don't know how to deal with it.
I really understand this
one. Do you?
Oh, God, I understand this one so well. And it's an interesting, I want to say, dichotomy, because so many actors have the drive for the thing you don't have. It's almost ubiquitous. It's almost a part of what one thinks of as an actor, because they have to have it because of what you said. You don't have the drive to go and get it. You don't get it, you know? So you're a kind of anomaly, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think those of us who are happy working here and doing this kind of work, like I know Doug would agree with me, and I know Jimmy would agree with me, and is that we're interested in just doing it.
Yes.
And And that's our reward.
And that's the gift that a repertory company can give to an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And there are not that many of them, repertory companies that...
there are like three.
Yeah, right. Do you know why that is?
Well, I think it's not cost effective for many places. I mean, we're a resort community, so people like fly down for like a weekend or a week or two, and they can see four plays.
Ah, I see.
You'd be hard pressed to find a theater in like the middle of like Kansas or something,
right,
where people flock to for the weekend.
Right, and the population wouldn't support it. The population pretty much supports it here.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did you get this?
What?
The award.
Oh, well, I guess this is the first year that the Oslo is one of the partner theaters of Ten Chimneys, and Michael was asked to submit a name or names. I don't know how many people he submitted.
Know.
No. I mean, but Michael called me at the end of the summer and said, I'm going to put your name in for Ten Chimneys. And I was very flattered and happy about that. And didn't really give it much thought.
Mm-hmm. Of course not.
Because, why should you? And then they called, I guess they do a review. I don't know how they review. I don't know anything. I mean, they looked at my resume and my picture, and maybe they Googled me or something. I don't know.
You don't have any idea how they chose you?
Well,
or what they saw, what they knew?
Part of the criteria is that it's a way to give back to actors who have served a community, have been of service in a community, and who have mentored people, like as we have for the students here, of giving back to them and allowing them to have a mentor and a master teacher.
Yes.
Because those of us who work in regional theater, not that we're looking for it, but we don't get recognition.
No.
You know, we don't get Tony Awards. Right. We don't get Emmy Awards. You know, we don't get awarded that stuff. What we do is serve a smaller community in the region.
Actually, you serve the art.
Yeah. Well, that too.
Yeah. No, that is what you do.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it is in other repertory companies, but I know that here you are extraordinarily valued. I mean, you can see it in opening night when people are hungry to tell you how much they appreciate you.
Well, it's a nice feeling. I'm happy to take congratulations. It's just we all depend on each other for doing a good job here. As rep actors believe that, if we're not making somebody else look good, and if they're not doing that for me, then we're screwed.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's what we do here. We don't concentrate on us. We concentrate on the people around
You're
us.
You're not trying to be a star. You're trying to be an ensemble.
Right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And there's a lot of things at play. You know, this is the quality of the play. There's the quality of the... I've done some of my best work in roles that aren't good. And those are the nights that people don't come rushing up to me and say, oh, good, because it wasn't like a featured part. But, I know that I've done some of my best work in roles that sort of, where the characters sort of disappear, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the only reason. And, everything's like the lighting designer and the costume designer, everyone has,
oh my God,
has, and the director, of course, has a piece of your performance.
Mm-hmm.
So... it's not all mine, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's everyone's performance, in a way.
Forgive me, but congratulations. it's clear that you deserve it. You're a wonderful, wonderful actor.
Well, thanks.
You're a terrific addition to this company. And I hope that everybody who hears this will find their way to Sarasota and get a chance to see David in whatever it is he's in, because it's truly, I've never seen you give a bad performance, and I have seen you do lots and lots of things.
Oh, there have been a few.
I believe you, but that would be your take on it, not mine. You want to tell us what you thought was a bad?
No.
And anyway, my guess is that your version of bad performance is... and not everybody else's. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
never mind.
No.
I think actually you're blushing.
I am.
Yes, I think you are.
Are you sure it's not a tan?
It's very sweet. Okay, so the other question I'd like to ask is, having given really all these years to acting, is there anything that you would say about what it means to have given your life to acting?
Like regrets?
Oh, no. Regrets? Well, I mean, if there are regrets, you can talk about them.
No, I have no regrets. Really.
No, no. So every time that you've thought, well, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, you have come back around to...
Well, you know, that was, it's as I said, it's hard to be an actor, and those thoughts usually were tempered by an economic stress.
Yes.
That's not to say I'm rolling in it now either,
right.
But I've come to see that it's not, you know, I'd much rather be doing something that makes me happy than thinking about, you know, am I going to be like living on the street when I'm 75?
Yeah, right.
Because, you know, I probably won't be.
No.
I have enough people in my life who love me who won't allow that to happen, I hope.
And anyway, one can act when one is 75. I mean, we have David.
Oh, yeah, David.
You know.
He's who I want to be when I grow up.
Everybody wants to be David. And to have a David in your life, oh my God.
Yeah.
We're talking about David Howard, who is also, who I also interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an amazing interview, if you're looking to look through interviews of mine. And David's been a member of the company for, do you know? I
think, well, David actually hasn't been in the rep for, we actually looked this up on my iPad in the hallway the other night with him, because he couldn't remember what was last season as a rep actor here, and I think it was 2005. I think it was 2005. He's come back and done like single roles.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't, you know, he can't, doesn't want to do the rep anymore.
No,
it's just too hard.
It's too hard.
It's
know.
It's like the Actors Olympics out there. It's crazy.
I'll tell you the truth. I stand completely in awe of the learning of the words. I mean, my God, the words you have to say in Clybourne Park.
There are a lot of them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know.
I was worried about that one.
I don't blame you. And at the same time, to be doing it, were you doing Glengarry at the same time at all?
Performing them, no.
No.
But we were
in rehearsal
rehearsing.
For the one?
No, it had, now I can't remember.
Well, why would you? I mean, you know.
I think Glengarry closed before Clybourne went into rehearsal.
Okay.
Like the week before.
Right. But you were doing, You Can't Take It With You at the same time you were doing Glengarry.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. It's a feat, even just to observe that you actually get the words. I mean, not to mention that you inhabit them with the character and that you manage to look like a different person. So you'd rather do something that you love than worry about...
Well, it's the message of You Can't Take It With You.
Yes, it is.
I mean, that's a play about actors.
Yes, it is. About artists, really.
Yeah.
Right? About people who give their life to the art that they love,
mm-hmm.
and don't worry about the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's wonderful. It's a good place to stop. Thank you, David.
Hey, thank you.
So once again, we hear the theme. I'd rather be doing something that I love than worrying about the future or really anything else. It is this idea that I can be so committed to who I am, to what I need to do, to what I love, that I can put aside those concerns which drive so many people, which are the motivation for so many people to spend what Michael Leslie called living dead. So The Lynn Show is about being who you really are. It is about honoring the real you. It is my belief as a psychotherapist that unfortunately many of us are discouraged from being our complete self, encouraged to deny important aspects of ourselves to pretend that we are not somebody that we really are, that we don't love what we really love, that we don't have a skill we really have, that we don't have an impulse or a way of being. And it is my belief that life is better, more fulfilling, when you have access to all of who you really are. So I interview these people who have made their living or their life with something they love, because it is who they really are, in the hope that it is inspiring. So if something about this show has triggered in you the idea that there may be something about you which you have left behind, something important that you can't benefit from or use or access, and you'd like to pursue it, that is what psychotherapy is about. And if you'd like to talk to me about psychotherapy, either with me or someone else, you can find me at my website, thelynnshow.com. That's thelynne. Don't leave the E out,
which is
Lynn.
How I do it these days.
TheLynnShow.com.
Psychotherapy on the
you
go.
Can click you on can listen to the first chapter
says,
of my
email
book.
Me or contact
when
me.
You can, you will.
You
why
can read
you can't
my
always
article
do what
about
you want
psychotherapy
to do
and
on
what
the
to
telephone.
Do about it.
You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. Well, since these two interviews took up most of the show, let me say that I hope, as always, that you got something that you can use from this show. Perhaps you simply enjoyed listening to these two delightful, interesting, thoughtful men, as I did. Maybe you found some of it funny, as I did. Maybe you were inspired to pay more attention to what it is you love in your life. But hopefully you found something there that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And I sure hope you will be, too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see, my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Fiend